From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Monday in a wooded area known as the Ramble in New York City's Central Park. A white woman was walking her unleashed dog, which is a violation of the Ramble's rules. An avid bird watcher was also in that area of the park, and when he noticed the dog tearing through plants, he asked her to put the dog on a leash. When the woman, Amy Cooper, refused, the situation escalated. That bird watcher is Christian Cooper, no relation. He's an African-American man. He told news outlets he carries a bag of dog treats with him when he's bird watching in case there are incidents like this one. He said when he shows the dog owners the treats, they usually leash their dogs to restrain them from taking the food. That didn't happen this time. Things went from bad to worse. Amy threatened to call police, and Christian Cooper pulled out his phone and took video. As Amy Cooper said, quote, "I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life," end quote. When the police arrived, Amy and Christian had left, but the video went viral. Amy Cooper was terminated from her job at an investment firm and surrendered her dog to the rescue organization from which she had adopted it. She made a public apology and said she didn't mean any harm to the African-American community. But her actions reflect the history of African-Americans being falsely reported to police, which can sometimes have tragic consequences. Christian Cooper said he videotaped the incident to document it, stating, quote, "Unfortunately, we live in an era with things like Ahmaud Arbery, where black men are seen as targets. This woman thought she could exploit that to her advantage, and I wasn't having it," end quote. This hour, we discussed the Central Park incident and its broader implications on race, privilege, and police-community relations. I'd like to welcome on the line with us Amanda Chestnut, is a local artist and educator. Amanda, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
And Chris Thompson is a writer, engineer, comedian, and activist. Chris, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I guess I'm going to start with just some general reactions from both of you. I mean, you know, we've heard a lot this week, but I think it will be helpful for you to share with the audience how this video first landed with you, Amanda Chestnut. Go ahead.
I haven't watched the video. Hmm. I've read transcripts of the text. I have read descriptions of what happens in the video, but I haven't watched it. I don't think that beyond reading about it, I need to expose myself to any more of that trauma, because it is traumatizing to watch these videos over and over and over again. So I haven't watched it.
Chris Thompson, go ahead.
Well, I saw the video. I watched the whole thing. It's like a minute long, which is pretty much all you need. It was a little bit disturbing, like how cavalier she was with what she was saying. And it also kind of reminded me that, like, this actually happened to me in Rochester once. Like, I was going to get bagels, and someone called the police on me because my car was too close to theirs. And it turned out fine. Like, the police actually showed up, and I, you know, he just told me, you know, you can go about your business.
Chris, let me jump in. I want to make sure we understand what you mean. Your car was too... When did this happen?
This was about, I want to say, 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
I was just going to a little bit. Bagel shop. There was a car parked. He was over the line of his own parking space, and I'm parked next to him in my line, and I could get out of my car. So, like, I'm 200 pounds. Okay, I'm 220 pounds.
And don't make me laugh at this.
So if I can get out of my car, he can get in his car. Like, it wasn't really a big deal, but he tried to make it a big deal. Like, he came out of the bagel shop. He told me to move the car, or he was going to drag my car with his. And I told him that I got a picture of his license plate, so if he does that, you know, I'll get a call from my insurance. Then he threatened to call the police. So I went into the bagel shop. I got my bagels. And by the time I got the bagel, I was trying to get there and out before any cops would come, because I was actually really afraid for my life. And as soon as I got my bagels, I got my car, I drove up to where the cop was, and he was just like, "You can go on, sir. Have a nice day." And I filmed all of it because, again, I was scared for, like, what would happen. But also, it was like in a completely ludicrous situation, just like this. Like a guy said, please leash your dog in a place where you're supposed to be leashing your dog, and this is the way she reacts. Like, that's not cool.
Your situation, though, yeah, as you say, it turned out okay. Did you hear from anybody after that, the guy involved?
Yes, I did. I heard from his employer first, and then I heard from him. So the employer apologized profusely for what happened and everything. And then, like, just, you know, maybe 15 minutes later, I get this apology from him through email, you know, saying that he was out of sorts. Excuse was, but, you know, standard, sorry I got caught type of excuse. Mm. And then that was the end of it. He asked me to take the video down, and, like, at the time, I did. Like, I have it on my phone, like, social.
Chris, and let me just jump in because we're kind of cutting out. So what we'll do is we'll reestablish Chris's connection so we can hear it a little bit better. You're hearing Chris Thompson describe the incident that happened with him, a writer, engineer, comedian, and activist. Amanda Chestnut's a local artist and educator who is with us. And we're talking about the Amy Cooper story, the incident between Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper that happened in New York City. In a part of Central Park called the Ramble earlier this week. You're probably familiar with that, but we're talking about the broader implications of this. And, you know, Amanda Chestnut, I try to keep events in context and talk about them and learn from them in ways that are appropriate and maybe not overgeneralized, but immediately this was an event that people were pointing to a long history of false reporting, intentional false reporting. And in this case, Amy Cooper was pretty clear that she was using it as a threat, even if it put Christian Cooper in danger here. What is the larger picture that you think maybe some Americans don't see when they see incidents like this and they think of them as one-offs, Amanda?
I think that anybody who is looking to do the research and who's really interested in becoming an ally and wants to gain a better understanding of this, a really, really good, basic, easy as in the language is easy, not that the content is easy to read resource is the Equal Justice Initiative Lynching in America report. If you can get your hands on a copy, I absolutely recommend it. It is a very good breakdown of how in this country we have moved from a history of lynching as a form of terrorism and control used on the Black population to having that lynching be sanctioned by the state through policing. The Lynching in America report goes through and counts and catalogs lynchings through the 1950s. But in every sense of the technical definition of the word lynching, they continue to this day. And I think that acknowledging this action as a lynching is crucial, and understanding the history of lynching in this country is crucial to gaining an understanding of why these things happen.
And Christian Cooper, Chris Thompson, Christian Cooper pulled out his cell phone to record video. You recorded video of the incident you described. And you've written, quote, had Cooper not had the sense to start recording, he could have been put in jail or worse, end quote. Chris, do you think African-Americans feel that recording as a protective measure is essentially necessary?
I think it is at this point. Like, we have been talking about this, just like Amanda was saying, this has been going on for a long time. And it's been going on to the point that, like, when it was being filmed, you know, it was the attackers filming and they were proudly filming it. Now we're at a point where we know that this is wrong, or most people know that this is wrong, but they keep making excuses. So, like, it's kind of taking the power of, like, the narrative, like,
taking it and giving it to the person who is being attacked by this or is being threatened. So I feel like it's very important, like, that if you can, you know, film it yourself, if you're being attacked by somebody, if someone is threatening to call the police in this manner and weaponize the police against you, that, yeah, it's very important to, like, film it or report it somehow. Because people just refuse to believe it if you don't. Like, I can list, like, a bunch of things that have happened to me just, like, riding my bike up and down the street or walking on the street that, like, when I talk about it, people just refuse to believe that it happened.
Chris, I guess that's kind of where I was going to go next here. I mean, in that incident yourself where you decide to start recording, how much are you actually processing in the moment? Are you thinking, boy, this is going to be my only chance to be believed if I get arrested or if this person attacks me because they could say that I was the aggressor or that they could make up something? Or is it almost instinctive at this point to say, like, you know, all right, pull out the cell phone and start recording it?
Well, for me, it was kind of a reactive thing, because once you said I'm going to call the cops, I knew that it would behoove me to record. Like, because I wasn't sure if at that point, I'm not even sure if Rochester or Monroe County had the police cams that they have. So
no, they didn't.
I knew
that
I was going to get arrested. They didn't?
It was before then, yeah.
Oh, it was before. Okay, yeah. So perfect. So yeah, even then, like, I wouldn't trust that anyway. So I was going to record it for myself. And if anybody said anything, I would have a recording of what happened. Maybe it should be instinctual, but it's kind of infuriating that I'm saying that I'm even, like, thinking about this being an instinctual thing to do. Like, this shouldn't even, like, we shouldn't have to do this. But maybe this is something that we should start thinking about, like, in order to protect yourself, you know, be ready, have your phone battery charged enough that, like, if something goes down, you can actually pull it out and record what's going on.
Amanda Chestnut, Christian Cooper followed up in a conversation with the New York Times yesterday and said, quote, any of us can make not necessarily a racist mistake, but a mistake. And to get that kind of tidal wave that she's received, Amy Cooper, in such a compressed period of time, it's got to hurt. It's got to hurt. I'm not excusing her racism, but I don't know if her life needed to be torn apart, end quote. He's talking about her losing her job, losing her dog, probably losing friends. Amanda, what do you make of Christian Cooper's response now to Amy Cooper and some of the very strong social media and public response to this woman, Amy Cooper?
I think that his response is noble and gracious. I also think that to a degree it is anticipated and expected, which is disappointing, that a victim would be expected to be so conciliatory immediately after having been traumatized like this. I think that in this day where it is so easy to become a person who is a subject of internet outrage for one reason or another, if you see someone pull a camera out on you, the next logical step might be to walk away if you don't want to deal with those repercussions. You were asking Chris, you know, was it logical to pull your camera out? And because you have to be so aware of who you are and who you will be into the future, every single moment of every single day, yes, you pull out a camera because you just have to be that thoughtful of who you are and who you are in space when you are a person of color. That doesn't just apply to Black people. And without that self-awareness, sometimes you wind up facing repercussions for your behavior. And those might be unpleasant if your behavior was unpleasant.
Any Chris, any sympathy at all? I mean, for what Amy Cooper has lost. I don't think Christian Cooper is extending sympathy per se. Well, I don't want to speak for... I'll let Christian Cooper's words stand on it. I don't need to speak for him. But what do you think, Chris?
Well, honestly, I took Christian Cooper's words with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
Because he does have a job. He's had writing jobs. I forgot where they said he currently works, but he's currently employed. And I wouldn't be surprised if he said all that because he wants to keep his job. Because if he sounds evil and vindictive about Amy Cooper losing her career and her dog and definitely a bunch of friends and social status, maybe that would reflect badly on his current job. That said, that's all speculation on my part, though. But
it is very easy to be painted as an angry black man.
Mm.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. so easy. So, like, I'm not saying anything for or against what he said, but like in regards to like all the repercussions that happened with Amy Cooper, yeah, just like Amanda said, she made that decision on camera when she knew the camera was rolling to say that she was going to lie to the police. And like all the implications of that, like all the way up to like him dying, were in there. So she lost her job, and maybe it is a deluge right now. But, like, if she is truly sorry for what she did, and I've read her apology, and it's one of the most hollow apologies I've ever seen, if she really wants to show how sorry she is, then she will work through this and actually make some sort of reform in herself and in society to show that she is, you know, that she is actually conciliatory and she is actually sorry for what she did. All these repercussions happen because of something that she did. We always talk about, like, all the time, anytime, you know, a black person is beaten or killed and it gets media attention, the first thing people say is that they should have taken responsibility for their action. So everything that's happening to her is what happened. So she needs to take responsibility for that. Like, I honestly didn't even care if she lost her job. Like, the dog definitely needed to be out of her hands. She was choking that dog. But, like, all the other things that have been happening to her, she's not allowed in Central Park anymore. She's banned from the whole park. She lost her job because the job is, a financial firm that needs to look like they stand up against racist things. And the financial industry has a history of doing a lot of racist things. So it's not a good idea to have somebody who's done a racist thing on their payroll. Like, all these things happened because of what she did. And like, maybe it was a deluge, maybe it was a lot, but that's what happened.
Now, it's actually the point Chris makes there, that these are all outcomes that come from her own behavior, and then asking, well, what happens when a black man, a black person, often a man, is arrested or involved in some sort of altercation? People say, well, you know, Ahmaud Arbery stopped into that home that was under construction. So as if it means anything, by the way. I mean, like, but there is this knee jerk. Well, you know, did they have marijuana on them? You know, did they rob a store 2 years ago? Is there anything on their record? As if that would justify a violent outcome that befell someone. I think that contrast is important. And let me ask both of you this, and Amanda, I'll start with you. You know, what we saw on camera with Ahmaud Arbery, I mean, interestingly enough, filmed by someone who was participating in the stalking of Ahmaud Arbery, but saw it on video nonetheless. What we saw in the Amy Cooper case, we saw in the murder of George Floyd, we have these things on video. We didn't always used to have this opportunity. And the conservative writer Matt Lewis wrote a couple of years ago, he wrote that the advent of the ubiquity of cameras has changed his view on these issues. He admitted that he often had a hard time believing the accounts that were contrary to what police were saying. He would tend to say, well, why would the officer lie about this? Or why would the officer tell a story that wasn't exactly what happened there? And with the advent of the camera everywhere, on cell phones, video, Matt Lewis said it has changed his view of this. It has opened his mind. Now, you can argue, and I think many have argued, that maybe it shouldn't have required that, but he said for him it did. How important is it now, Amanda, that people are seeing some of these claims, because what we see in the Amy Cooper case is a woman literally threatening, almost instinctively, hey, I'll just tell them that, you know, you're threatening my life. How important is it that we see this and we don't have the chance to say, well, maybe the officer wasn't kneeling on his head. Maybe the officer was threatened. Maybe he was attacking the officer. How important is this video evidence?
I think that as a animal, people are really, really bad at understanding things that they cannot see or touch. And this is, and it extends way beyond the experiences of racism. If you look at people who balk at having to wear a mask for COVID when they go out, it's because they can't. 100,000 dead is not a touchable number. It's not mm-hmm. something that our brains, as an animal, we can compute. It's just hard for us to understand things that we cannot see and touch. So when people say, oh, there's so much more racism now, it's not that there's more. It's that because we can now see it in a way that is broadly accessible, it feels like more to people who didn't have that access already. I've had that access. That's why I didn't watch that video. I've had that access mm-hmm. my whole life. Mm-hmm. I don't have to watch the video to know what happens. I don't have to watch the video to know the pitch of her voice and to know how she changes it when she feels like she's not going to be believed, and to know how she might have started to cry a little bit when they got there, because that's so much more believable now. And the police show up and she's crying at this angry black man. And yeah, I've seen that. I don't need to watch that video. But for people who haven't seen that before, it's really the only way of communicating it, because we've been saying it for generations and we're still not believed. So until it can be seen, it's not real for so many people, unfortunately.
What do you think, Chris?
I kind of agree with what he was saying. With what Amanda was saying and what the writer was saying, that, like, you know, we're visual people, and especially it seems like here in America, we're especially visual. Like, if we can't see it, we don't believe it. And we are obsessed with our, you know, our conspiracy theories, and we're obsessed with things happening in the background that we can't see. But, like, we need to see, like, whenever somebody brings up something like this, we have to see it. Like, I don't necessarily need to see that video ever again, just because it's something that I lived through and it's something that other people have lived through. But, yeah, we are just visual animals, and sometimes it truly takes someone viewing, you know, that whatever incident in order to believe that it happened, and that it happens regularly enough that, you know, it was able to be caught on camera in the first place.
Talking to Chris Thompson and Amanda Chestnut about not just the Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper altercation, but the long history of false reporting on African Americans, seeing is believing, what it takes to change a culture, and more. And got an email from a listener named Andrew, says, Evan, can your guests explain this Karen thing? So after our only break of the hour, we will address it. What Andrew is referring to is Christian Cooper himself, when he first posted about this incident, referred to Amy Cooper, maybe not knowing her name, as this Karen. And Christian Cooper's sister, when she posted about it on social media and posted the video, talked about the Karen that came out with the dog. And that is very much a meme. What is it about? What's the history there? We'll talk to our guests and talk about a lot more as well and take more of your feedback as well next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, President Trump wants to change the rules for how Twitter and other social media platforms can govern the content there. Is this an American response to this problem, or is this about suppressing speech? What does it mean for news going forward? We explore it. Then in our second hour, with warm weekends coming in summer, what should we expect of one another? Outside, common etiquette, behavior. That's Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Amanda Chestnut, you want to take the first crack at explaining to listeners who don't understand the Karen meme, what does it mean?
Oh, I was actually advocating on Twitter maybe yesterday that we stop using the word Karen and start using the word Carol after Carol Bryant. For those of you who don't know, is the woman who is alive and free and has lived to a ripe old age after having participated in the lynching murder of Emmett Till. She is the woman who accused him of looking at her and participated in his murder and in the cover-up of his murder. And she is, I think, if you look back historically, I know that there were earlier incidents, but she's the crown-wearing queen of weaponized white woman tears. Her tears caused the death of Emmett Till. And when we talk about Karens, they are women who either, and unfortunately, this is a word that is assigned to women as a woman-identifying person. That stings, and it should. These are women who use their tears and fear and anger as a point of malice and destruction against those they perceive as subordinate, whether that be a grocery store clerk or Emmett Till.
Chris Thompson, is that a pretty good definition of the Karen meme? We don't have Chris. Chris, are you there? Are you on mute? Oh, we're gonna reestablish with Chris. It's used a lot lately, Amanda. In fact, we've seen a lot more usage of this meme in just the last few months. I mean, it has kind of exploded. There's a lot of metrics for this stuff. And the metrics indicate that from March, just 2 months ago, to now, it's almost tripled in usage. Probably for incidents like this one, but also when we see viral video of someone, you know, screaming that they won't wear a mask, it's often accompanied now with, check out this Karen who won't wear a mask. Do you think the pandemic has sort of accelerated the usage of this into the popular lexicon?
I think the pandemic has accelerated a lot of what we, how we talk about each other. I've had a lot of conversations in the last couple of months about how I have witnessed a lot of tacit racism, and I think that both, I think in the variety, in the spectrum of our language, we're sitting around with not as much to do, and it's coming out in weird ways that are going to be formative as we wrap in this pandemic and as we start to return to normalcy, whatever that is. The ways we're engaging with each other right now are going to be formative in how society changes as a whole when we go back to broad engagement.
All right. Well, let me ask both of you to respond then to a piece that I've seen shared quite a bit today by a writer named Nina Burley, and she was writing on a couple different platforms, and her piece is called How the Karen Meme Benefits the Right. She writes, uncool, middle-aged white women are Democrats' best hope for unseating Donald Trump. So why does the online left hate them so much?
Sorry.
So,
I'm sorry. I can't.
Now, let me go ahead and quote her piece.
Okay, go ahead.
She identifies herself as probably a Karen. She writes, quote, no progressives, nor even standard-issue conservatives, would be caught videotaping and stereotyping any other group in the way they feel comfortable going after white middle-aged women. The fact is, it has never been politically incorrect to trash women as women. That is, women who cannot also claim to belong to another disadvantaged group by virtue of race, body weight, sexual preference, or disability. But why, in an era in which policy is being made overwhelmingly by white men at the national level, have women become the villains of the COVID era? Part of it is surely that it is easier and less scary for people to film women acting out than filming men doing the same. But the rise of the Karen meme since the pandemic started seems to indicate something deeper at work, end quote. All right, Amanda Chestnut, you want to take
that? First of all, if you look at the history of voting in this country, it is not white women who are going to save us from Donald Trump. I am really sorry, white women. I wish you were there for us as someone who would love to be saved from Donald Trump. I'm hoping you all turn up. But if you look at the demographics and the history of voting in this country, that's not going to be the demographic that saves us. And I'm not a white woman, so I don't know what that feels like. But I do have enough access to 548 and whoever else who runs the numbers, and that's not it. I do think that there is a history of white women siding with oppressive elements, everywhere from domestically to nationally. Go from the household to local government to state government, go regional, go national, for preserving what little amount of freedom and access they have had. I am a firm believer that no one is free until we all are. I want to stand side by side and shoulder to shoulder with all women moving towards our freedom. But as someone who has had to leave workplaces because of white women tears, we're not there yet.
Chris Thompson, go ahead.
Okay. So I cut off just for a little bit. Did we get into the history of the new Karen controversy?
Yeah, sure.
Coming from the turf?
Coming from the what?
It came from a turf. It was a tweet from a trans exclusionary radical feminist.
I did
Julie
not talk
Dent.
About that, no.
Okay. So, yeah. So the entire Karen is a slur thing is the source of this one woman who has done a lot of really good things for women, but is also extremely transphobic and decided, and also racist, and then decided that this Karen thing is something that needs to be put out there as like some sort of, as a slur. Even though we've been using Karen, Brenda, Janet, like all types of different names for privileged women and privileged people in general. We've got Tylers and Bobs and Grants that we use to just discuss like this tacit like sense of privilege over something just because it's not going your way. So like the entire use of Karen, and especially in this time when people are acting up just like just too much, honestly, you know, the entire, like, the whole idea of Karen being anything more than calling out someone abusing and using their privilege for something that they don't truly deserve is kind of ridiculous. That's how I feel about it.
All right, listeners, if you want to weigh in with questions or comments, Andrew, I hope we answered that for you. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Kathy writes the following email. In response to comments about the human need for visual confirmation of seeing video of incidents, I would add that what we have in shocking abundance is a lack of empathy. We cannot imagine what others are feeling or experiencing, and white people like me have to grow our empathy by looking inside at our own privilege. That is from Kathy. What would you say to that, Amanda Chestnut?
Yeah. I try really hard to even recognize my own privilege. I can't think that... I like to think that if, as a woman of color, I am willing to do that work, the people who wish to be allied and aligned with the work that I am doing would also be willing to be as introspective as, at least as introspective as I am. I just received a message from someone who said that they're not going to call in, but in connection with Emmett Till and the Carols, she wanted to say that Miss Cooper's performance, quote unquote, could be used as a soundtrack for the rape scene in A Birth of a Nation. I'm not suggesting you watch her video to double check it, but it was the first thing she thought of when she saw it. This is a history. Chris, I had compared Miss Cooper and Karen's to Carol from the Emmett Till lynching.
Mm-hmm. Chris Thompson, what would you say to Kathy's email?
I do agree with it. Like, empathy is something that we very much lack. And I feel like for some people, empathy is something implicit, but I feel like you can develop empathy without having to see a horrible thing. And I feel like this needs to be something that's taken, like, that's not taken care of, but something that's taught, like, from a very early age. Like, I feel like a lot of people think that they're teaching empathy when they're just teaching, like, projecting empathy, if that makes any sense at all. But, like, I think that it would help to, you know, mend fences and build bridges so that, like, when these things happen, we don't need to see an actual video of someone being murdered or threatened in order to believe it and know that it's wrong.
844-295-TALK. If you want to join the conversation or if you want to continue with emails, and we've got a bunch, connections@wxxi.org. Rachel writes to us, says she's a white woman who has this sign on her car. She sends me a picture, and the sign says, "Raise your voice, make racism wrong again." She says the sign has been in my car for months. In late December, commuting from Canandaigua back to Rochester, an individual felt the need to flip me off and do the Heil Hitler salute out his window. I encountered him two more times that day and was really glad that I had reported him to the New York State Police, as oddly enough, he was driving back into Canandaigua at the same time I was returning and started the whole routine again, even when he was at a stoplight with plenty of witnesses, all because of the sign. He was arrested mainly because he was supposed to be driving with an interlock device, it turned out. The whole situation astounded me, his violent reaction, including pulling up alongside me, I'm a white woman, and screaming at me while going 60 miles an hour plus on 490. A 22-year-old male with some previous charges, but unreal, I fear, for our society. Chris, have you, Rachel's describing an incident with one person, and she is a white woman. Is this commonplace at all in your experience as African-American male in this society? I mean, does this happen with any more routine for you?
I used to have this joke. Well, I guess I still have this joke about, like, being in Rochester at least once a month, something, if you're a person of color, at least once a month, something racist is going to happen to you. And, like, sure enough, like, my first month in Rochester, cop pulled me over and accused me of stealing my own car, even though I had the registration and everything. And then, like, every month after that, with the exception of a couple of gaps, something ridiculous happens to me on the street or, like, in a store or something. Like, this, somebody being that brash, I hate to say it, but I might chalk that up to, like, Canandaigua, because I know there is one guy in Canandaigua that has a Confederate flag blazoned across the back of his truck.
So I heard he got it ripped off his truck last week.
Oh, yes, he did, and it is hilarious. And thank you. I forgot who posted about that, but if you're listening, thank you. Oh, it's horrible. It's a huge thing. But, like, I walk down the street and people have hurled racial epithets at me. I would ride my bike and somebody would say something really untoward to me. And, like, it's not just because I'm riding a bike, because Rochester, for some reason, really hates bike riders. But, like, people on the street would say something to me. I had somebody try to throw something into the spokes of my bike to have me trip over, and he, you know, called me the N-word and told me I need to be out of the street, you know. So, yeah, this happens all the time, and I'm sorry that this happened to the person writing, but I'm also glad that, like, the person got caught and was arrested, because usually they just get away with it.
Amanda, you want to add to that?
Yeah, welcome to the club, to the person writing. Thanks for joining the fight.
Just to kind of put a point on what Amanda Chestnut was saying earlier, if any listeners are surprised to hear that white women went for Donald Trump, 47-45 from a Time magazine study of the data in the 2016 election. So, yes, white women voted a plurality in favor of Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. Now, the newest Quinnipiac poll came out 1 week ago. And this is a national poll. Again, you know, you take it for what it's worth, because in elections, it's swing states. But look at how some of these numbers break down. Donald Trump's massive lead comes from an almost 30-point lead among white men. White women in the new Quinnipiac poll have Biden at 52, Trump 41. That would be a 13-point turnaround from Trump winning by 2 among white women in 2016 if it held up. I know it's early. By the way, women overall, Biden 59, Trump 31. So women who are white make it a lot closer. Women in general favor Biden almost 2-1 over Donald Trump right now. Amanda Chestnut, are any surprise at those numbers? Does that encourage you at all that right now, at least, it's a 13-point difference than 4 years ago?
Yes, there's an asterisk on that one, because 13 points is not a lot of points. And he's yet to pick a running mate. And given what's happening in Minnesota, if it's Klobuchar, then we're going with a totally different ball of wax. So, I'm gonna wait and see on those numbers, and we can totally talk about it in a couple of weeks.
You say that about Klobuchar, given her history, her prosecutorial history?
Yes.
Okay. Chris Thompson, do those numbers surprise you at all?
They surprised me a little bit, and I'm trying to take them with a grain of salt, because we've had we did a lot of miscalculations in 2016 when it came to Clinton and Trump. So, yeah, the numbers, a double-digit lead isn't that bad. But also, like Amanda said, it's 13, give or take. And I'm not sure what factors they're adding into this poll to know how accurate a prediction it is. And, honestly, we haven't even hit June yet. It's a couple of days away, but, November's going to be a long time.
Sure, sure.
Take it with a grain of salt.
I want desperately for white women to show up. So I'm hoping those numbers are inaccurate and that there will be even more people voting.
Okay. Amanda, when it comes to the Cooper story, the Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper altercation, is there any realistic hope? Is there reason to think that the wide public knowledge of this, that the velocity that this story has gained, and the shaming and the loss of a job, the loss of her dog, the loss of the privilege to go to Central Park, those kind of things, could that be a kind of inoculant on future interactions like that? I mean, do you believe that? Do you think that the more we talk and shine a light on this stuff, the more likely it is to stop it from happening in the future? Or does it require something else to prevent it from happening in the future?
It could, but it hasn't been so far. Mm-hmm. So she's not the first person to show her rear and lose her job for it. She lost her job awful quickly, which is appreciated. By me at least, but, that doesn't, you know, I'm not so sure she's going to be the last person to have that happen to them. So, I wish that more people would take it as a cautionary tale and think twice before calling the cops on someone who doesn't need the cops called on them. But, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Chris, do you sense that this could be an inoculant on future incidents like this at all?
This specifically, no. But America has a very long history of patting themselves on the back for, you know, doing justice, but then not continuing. So, like, we've had, like, a racism problem since 1776. And all the achievements we've done to get past it, we still refuse to talk about it. So I feel like more talking about this and being frank and being open to the discussion without, like, you know, leaning on old tropes and everything would actually help this inoculate us a little bit more. So when we see this, when someone sees something like this happening, they'll know what it is, and, you know, they'll see it for what it is. So I feel like more conversations like this, and more conversations, you know, outside of, I guess we're not in the studio now, but, you know, more conversations outside of the show need to happen with people in order for this to actually truly be prevented again.
I'll let Amanda take a crack at Michael's email. Michael says, so it's okay to use stereotypes of white women? React to ingrained stereotypes that caused the problem to begin with by creating new stereotypes to defeat it? We must all get beyond the use of all stereotypes. That's from Michael. Amanda.
No one said anybody is stereotyping. Both Chris and I very explicitly said that the Karen meme is used in response to weaponized privilege.
Actual documented incidents.
Yeah, it's a reaction to something that has already happened. It's not a stereotype.
Okay, so in other words, the stereotype would be if all white women were Karens. That
right.
Would be the,
right. Right.
Okay.
Right, and that's not at all what either of us have said or
okay.
Implied.
Chris, you agree with that?
Yeah, like, we didn't say anything about all white women. We said white women who use their power, use their privilege and abuse it. Like, that's not all white women. Like, I can tell you for a fact that there are plenty of people, even in the Black Lives Matter group, that aren't like that. Or they use their privilege for good. Like, it's not, there's no stereotyping going on. The only stereotype
it's not even a stereotype of privilege. It's just weaponized privilege.
Right.
Michael, I hope that at least clarifies their position on that, that it's not a desire to stereotype, it's a desire to respond to actual documented incidents. And the shorthand is not meant to describe all people in a category, but the actual actions that have been documented. Okay. Well, down to our last 90 seconds or so. Amanda, you said you couldn't even watch this video, and I certainly understand it. Are you hopeful, though, that most people will make themselves watch to understand, you know, whether it's this, whether it's the murder in Minneapolis, whether it's others?
No. I think if you really need to understand, there are plenty of things that you can do, starting with having real heartfelt conversations with your friends and colleagues about their own personal experiences. And I think that would be much more meaningful both to them and to the individual than watching a video online.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I think we need to get to the point where we don't need to have these videos come out for people to believe and empathize with us and do something about it. So if we can get to that point, that would be a lot better than, you know, continually, like, having to carry around the camera and photograph and videotape our lives in order for people to believe the things that we are saying.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to come on with us and to discuss it, and certainly appreciate it, though I share the sentiment. Wish you were talking about something else. Chris Thompson, a writer and engineer, comedian and activist. Thank you, Chris. Nice talking to you. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, soon.
Amanda Chestnut, a local artist and educator. Always appreciated. And again, sometime soon we'll see you in person. But thanks for being on the line with us, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, listeners. Hope you have a nice Thursday afternoon wherever you are. And from the whole team here, Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer, I'm Evan Dawson. We will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.